I've been very, very passionate over the years about training people in such a way that they end up using solution focused in a way that kind of fits for them, kind of comes out of their mouth in a way that sounds right for them, and is in some ways appropriate to the setting which they work.
That is Simply Focused with Elfie Chaney and Dominic Gooden for live enjoyment.
Are you ready for this new episode? Then please welcome your hosts, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godin.
Hi, and welcome back to episode number 72 of the Simply Focus podcast.
We are sitting here with John Wheeler. Hi, John.
Hi.
And we're in Wrighton, one of the two healthiest places in England. And we're really enjoying our time together with John and Marie. We had a wonderful workshop with your colleagues. Yeah. It's always so nice to spend quality time together. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, it's been an absolute delight.
We actually felt very honored when you approached us a few months ago and invited us to do a workshop here in Wrighton. And the way how everything came up was so beautiful. And yeah, we enjoyed our time yesterday with amazing participants. They all went through your training, your 5 days training on solution focused, and you're a solution focused practitioner, trainer and supervisor for many, many years. You run your company Solution Focused Trainers in Wrighton. It's actually a bunch of amazing practitioners so who join you in this company, like Naomi Whitehead, Tara Gratton, Kitch Burns
and Stefan Nattenjack,
whom we haven't met yet. We're looking forward to this encounter.
Yeah.
And you got in touch with Solution Focus a long time ago, so we're very curious. What was it that fascinated you back then, and what is it today that fascinates you about Solution Focus?
Yeah. So right at the beginning, so 1991, as a trainer, I often go back to that, so it's very vivid for me. Though some might be an invented memory, I don't know. But what was really vivid, to be frank, it came for me at a time when my work in a child and adolescent mental health service had started to become a little samey. I was kind of losing touch with the uniqueness of the people that were coming along. Also, whilst I was getting reasonable outcomes, I wasn't getting as many good outcomes as I wanted. And I guess this wasn't the first time I went to a workshop hoping I'd find something that would work better. So I was interested in that. I think the first part of the day was quite a weird experience, because I realised now that a lot of the assumptions, not only were they counterintuitive to me, but they were quite the opposite of how I was working as a professional. That working in a child mental health service, I saw myself, and we all saw ourselves, as the experts who would assess. We'd collect information and then we'd make recommendations. And in some ways it pains me to think about just how much time was devoted to that. I remember, I think, one parent saying, this is the third meeting, when will we start to look at changing things? And they said, well, we haven't finished the assessment yet. We'll come back to that next week. And then, oh, dear me. Yeah, so the day, what absolutely fascinated me, I think several things. One was what happened to me when I did the exercises. So these very odd exercises that asked me to think in ways I hadn't been asked to think before. And I was just absolutely intrigued and could immediately see, you know, these would be useful conversations with the families I worked with, the parents. And then seeing the videos, as Chris Iveson, so seeing his clients, they were all animated and energized, and you could just see it in the non-verbals. I don't know if this is the truth or not, but I could imagine myself thinking, well, you know, my clients don't look like that. Maybe this is people from London or something, you know. No, it's not that. It's the questions he's asking. So by the end of the day, I think two things had happened. One was, although the assumptions were counterintuitive and odd, the ethics of the approach were very, very comfortable. I had a distinct sense that this is how I've always wanted to work. This is the closest I'd found to what I imagine should be out there, you know? Yeah, and I'm just incredibly eager to be back at work on the Monday. And I often say in training, you know, this was unusual, 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, saying, I want to be back at work on Monday and I want everyone to turn up so we can try this stuff out. And I had a very kind of strong sense that this will take me into aspects of people's lives I've never asked about before. You know, we have this saying, you know, people are bigger than the problems they come with. And it's a whole realm of people's lives that I was going to be able to ask about and be curious about and help them notice, hopefully. Yeah. So absolutely fascinated me. Yeah.
So how did your conversations change then?
I think on that Monday, I feel very sure that people I'd already seen before could have guessed I'd been on training, because I was asking completely different questions and I was coming at the conversation in a completely different way. And suddenly I'm interested in what works, you know, as opposed to what doesn't. So that was a change. And I think it was a gradual change. For me, I think there's a default position of having ideas about other people's lives and what I think would be good for them. And I'm not sure I've entirely lost that. And I comment on that when I train as well, because I say, well, you know, this is often what we do when we want to help people who are in difficulty. This comes from a good place. It comes from our heart, it seems to me, wanting the best for people. So how the conversation changed was, yeah, a lot more space for people to work things out for themselves. Conversations that are based on assumptions that people will work things out. I think some of the questions I asked weren't even from the training. They just sat with the assumptions. So a mother and a daughter would name something they're struggling with, and I'd just say, so what are you planning to do about that? And they had plans. This is great.
That's wonderful. And listening to you talking about assumptions, you yesterday shared this lovely story how Greg Winnicomb and you started your journey on putting together a training course on solution focus, and yeah, assumptions were an important part in that.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, I was so pleased to be able to work with Greg, because I felt we shared a lot. But we also had differences that meant that a richness came out of our debate and disagreement and so on. You know, we were more than the sum of our parts, if you like, because of that. But the assumptions, both of us were very much wedded to the idea that it's not enough to just teach people the tools. It's really important for people to understand the assumptions that they sit on. And this work, for it to work well, for it to be as fantastic as it can be, it requires a shift in people's mindset, or people being committed to a particular mindset. Sometimes practitioners on training turned out they had the mindset anyway, and they say, ah, there's a name for what I do, you know. But others, it's a shift, and it's a very deliberate shift in the mindset, yeah, the assumptions, yeah.
And Greg had 12 assumptions.
He had 12
you
assumptions.
Had 4 assumptions.
I had 4 assumptions.
And that was an invitation to go through further assumptions and then to somehow came up with your specific set of assumptions that you use in training. Can you share a little bit about this process and also about the assumptions?
And I think there's something of a clue to how solution-focused exists in the world, if you like, that whenever people write books, often there'll be a list of assumptions and they'll include the assumptions that make most sense to them. And then you look at two different books and they're kind of similar things, but they're not exactly the same. And this is what we have. And sometimes I say in training, you know, in some ways it'd be useful if there were like the 10 commandments of solution focused practice, but unfortunately there aren't. You know, this is where we're at. So Greg and I, we looked at all the kind of common lists of assumptions and we kind of just mapped them out. It seemed to us that they fell into 4 groups, and then there are kind of lists within each group, but just 4 groups. So assumptions about the people we work with, assumptions about change, assumptions about problems, assumptions about practice. And then with that, then there are, you know, kind of specific assumptions, yeah.
You wrote an article about that.
Yeah, so
where can we find this?
So that's
article?
In context. And we've decided the title was deliberately chosen as Some Assumptions. You know, this is our attempt, so this is just going to be another list. And it's as good as people judge it to be, but it's another one to look at. It's a kind of a map, you know.
And what difference did looking at the assumptions so closely make for you in your work?
I think for me, it kind of keeps me on track. That exercise you did yesterday with the, you know, the 4 quadrants, you know, positive, negative, past, future, and kind of now, and to map out the questions we ask, it helps me to make sure I'm in the quadrant I would want to be, because I know from experience of using solution focus, that's going to be most useful to people. That's the best thing I've got to offer. There's another quadrant which can be thought of as whether one is person-centered or, in a sense, sort of practitioner-centered, and whether you're being influential or not influential. And so with that quadrant, solution focus sits nicely in person-centered and influential. And in the early days, and even now it could happen, I guess, I'll look at the conversation and think, oh, I've drifted into one of the others. And I, by and large, finding clients incredibly forgiving. And it doesn't matter that we've wandered into an unhelpful or ineffective quadrant. It's that we notice we have, and we do something to get back to the useful one. Mm. Yeah.
reminds me of the picture yesterday in the workshop of a dance or kind of a journey through the conversation and how we navigate through the conversation. And sometimes we get back to maybe a place we don't want to be, and then we can try to navigate or orient our communication partners towards something maybe more useful. So it's not about the question, it's just about the journey, the dance, the navigation through that.
Yeah. A very specific example of that, because I use a session rating scale, outcome rating scale. And for those who use session rating scale, people will know there's a very high threshold for testing therapeutic alliance. And there's a client I was working with, and the research behind it would suggest that if you don't cross the line of adequate therapeutic connection by three sessions, you know, you won't see the person again, probably not come back. So with this person, by the third session, we hadn't crossed it, but she did want to come back. So I thought, well, okay, I've got another chance. And when I looked at her marking of the four domains, it was about her being confident that I was listening to her, which was an incredible shock. People tell me I'm a good listener. What do I have to change so she'll have a sense that I am hearing what she's saying? And I realized it was one of these dynamics where the person would say a lot and then say, did you get that? I don't know if that makes sense. And I say, yes, it makes sense. And I thought, hang on, that's not enough. I've got to do some sort of a summary here. I've got the feedback, what I've heard. And so in the next session, I smile at this because I came to a moment where, this is where I've got to be better. I've got to do what many would call active listening, you know? So I fed back and I said, so essentially what you're saying is da 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 da. And she said, no, that's not it at all. I thought, oh, no. And said, well, what is it? She said, it's da 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 da. Said, so it's da 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 da. Yes, that's it. And that was the session where we crossed the line for therapeutic alliance. It's incredible. So mistakes can happen, and mistakes can come better connections. You talked yesterday about calibration, you know. People of my age will remember radios that were made of a substance called Bakelite, and you would have two dials on it. There is a macro dial. And so in the UK, if we wanted to listen to good pop music, we'd listen to Radio Luxembourg. Yeah, this is going back a long, long way. And you'd have the dial which roughly found Radio Luxembourg. And then you'd have a fine tuner. You'd get exactly. And you've got all the noises, all the distortions that you've got perfect reception. And I think our work is like that. There's a kind of macro dial of getting roughly connected. And then we do that further work to be absolutely connected. Yeah.
And I think this is such a beautiful example you just gave with your client in really learning from the client. And, well, as solution-focused practitioners, we often talk about deliberate listening or constructive listening instead of active listening. And then learning from the client how important it is, and then to change and do those summaries is, to me, a really beautiful example of what it means to go on a journey together with a client and yet being solution focused.
Yeah. And it also reminds me, we had an excellent workshop by Bill O'Hanlon here, you know, many years ago. And he threw a question out to the group. He said, so where can you get your best supervision? And people had various ideas. They said, it's the client. It's the client. Watch the client. The client is giving you instant, second by second feedback on the usefulness of what's going on. Pay attention, watch.
Oh, that's a great keyword, supervision. Well, Bill O'Hanlon too.
Yeah.
And yet I'm today very much interested in your perspective and fascination also about supervision. You have been working in the field of supervision
For many years.
What is it that you love about the work there, and, well, what do you do there?
Well, I mean, I wrote a chapter on supervision, a book that Frank Thomas and Tharana Nelson edited, and one of the first things that caught my eye was that there's a kind of date when people start writing about solution-focused practice, and then there's a kind of date when people start writing about solution-focused supervision, and it's not the same date. You know, it's several years later, which reflected my experience working as a social worker and therapist who had, I had social work students on placement with me. It was several years into using solution focus with clients before it dawns upon me, oh, hey, I could put it into this conversation as well. This conversation is about helping people be at their best as well. So surely scaling questions, miracle questions, the whole lot will have a place, surely. And I think for any of us who are experienced, I mean, it can create a sort of a challenge because, you know, if there's a difference in experience between the supervisor and the supervisee will look to the supervisor to give ideas, tips, what would you do, and so on. And as a practitioner, that's a, rather a nice place to be in. You know, the sleuth work supervision approach then becomes helping them become as big as they can in their practice as imaginative, creative, and so on. Yeah, and to own their own resources more confidently, more knowledgeably, figure out next steps that make sense to them and are more likely to be acted upon, all of this, you know. So I've had a lot of fun doing that, yeah.
So what is your special solution-focused twist in supervision? It might be different than other people doing solution-focused supervision.
Well, there's maybe nothing novel. I would always start off a supervision relationship with a contract. So, and that's all crafting solution-focused questions. What do you need to be doing? What do I need to be doing? What do we need to be doing together for this to be useful to you? And that has been splendidly useful because a person who's very experienced will say, you know, I really want to work things out for myself. You know, I want you to take me to further levels of competence and so on. Another person will say, I'm really new to this and I've heard you know a lot about this. So I want some teaching. So that kind of legitimizes that, you know, with that person, there are times when the teaching hat goes on and it's clear that that's what it is, you know? Yeah, so that's the beginning. Yeah, tips, my special take, different from person to person, really. And also, I would add, you know, just as we have session rating scale, there's a nice set of rating scales for supervision as well. Which I'll show it in Florence so you can get feedback. And with that one supervisor, he put a mark on one of the lines and I said, what would have to be different for that mark to be higher? And he said, I talk at length, you're going to have to interrupt me more because that's just what I do. You know, if this isn't going to make a difference, you're going to have to cut me off a lot more than you do, which, okay, we'll do that then. I wouldn't have otherwise because it feels impolite to interrupt. Yeah. So there are tools I use. I think a question that kind of really, really was very frequent in my head, you know, when I hear people talking about their practice would be, and what do you want from this conversation about this? What difference do you think, reflecting on this now, what difference could it make? What could be changed? What could be better as a result of you reflecting upon this now? And invariably people kind of stop in their tracks and decide, oh, I've probably told you enough about the case or the challenge or whatever, and what do I want? And then you get the unique stuff. So one practitioner will say, ideas, I need more ideas, and then we'll go straight to scaling. How many have you got? Four. You know? Or another one will say, confidence, you know, I think I know what I need to do, I just need to be confident. Okay. Scale of 0 to 10. Off we go. So whatever can easily be put on a scale or miracle question, put it in the middle of a miracle question, you know, between now and next time you meet the client. If you had more of that, how would you be able to tell what would that look like when you're next with the client? So it's typical solution-focused stuff, you know, when we know what people want, all the other tools fall into place, you know.
And doing supervision with your clients, how do you do it? Do you talk about it? Do they bring tapes from sessions? So in a very practical sense.
Well, again, it's varied a lot. So some have brought tapes and that's been absolutely delightful, kind of see the practice. Yeah, and others who would be reflecting on what's happened, yeah. So different formats. Over the years, I mean, I trained as a family therapy supervisor, so I've done life supervision as well. So no, that was good fun, yeah.
And if you want to see and experience John doing supervision and teaching supervision, come to the EBTA conference, the EPTA conference, September 12th through 14th this year. And John will host a post-conference workshop about solution-focused supervision there. You also brought some pictures with you today. What are these pictures about?
Yeah, okay. So this is audio, so people won't see this as I hold it up to you. But what I'm holding up to Dominic and Alfie, it's a picture of a rhinoceros artist. Now, of course, a rhinoceros has a horn on his nose. So when we look at all the paintings he's done, they're wonderful representations. At the moment, he's doing a painting of an elephant. And every single painting also has a horn on it. And such is the nature of being a human being, I think. We notice what we notice. We don't notice what we don't notice. And we don't notice we're not noticing what we're not noticing, as it were. And so that's just how it is. There are all these influences on us. I had an experience in counselling training which both kind of shocked me but also amused me, where there are 30 of us on this counselling training. One person volunteered to talk about something going on in their lives and the trainer did a counselling session for about 20 minutes. We all had to write down what we thought were the kind of main issues in the client's life, you know, so we kind of wrote down and then it was finished and then we all shared what we thought were the main issues. Well, there were 29 of us and we had more or less 29 different issues, you know. And then the bit that kind of really threw most of us, she said, okay, now get into peers and see whether those issues have any sort of significance in your own life. You know, I looked at my list, you know, I said, I think he has issues with his mother. And I thought, oh, goodness, how did that get in there? That's rather familiar. And all of us had written something that was very familiar in our own lives. So I think there is that. In the UK, we have a family therapist, John Burnham, who's written a paper about social graces. And I don't know how well it's well known, this social graces, but he uses the word graces, where G stands for gender, R stands for race, A stands for ability and age, C stands for class and culture, E ethnicity, S sexuality. So we're all influenced in these ways in terms of who we are and our identity. And yeah, as a male, have a certain limitation in viewing the world, and a woman would have a different take. So there are differences. And I do wonder if there's something really important about the beginning of Solution Focus, that it was mixed gender. You know, there were men and women there, and then the two most prominent ones were a man and a woman. So at the very least, you get those two different perspectives. And I remember seeing Stephen and Sue once, and it was nice to see them disagreeing with each other, that they had different perspectives, you know. So there's something about, I think we have to be mindful of this, you know, in a sense we're all like this artist rhinoceros that have a horn in front of us, and all of us have a horn of some sort, but we won't know what it is. Yeah, we won't know what it is. And in a way, where we're at in terms of solution-focused now, it's both a fascinating place in terms of all the diversity, all the manifestations and so on. I know, because Steve often said this, his hope very much was that it would stay alive and people wouldn't do things that would pin it down and take the life out of it, you know? And for me, that's the challenge to all of us, really, to maintain some sort of global representation of what was happening in Brief Family Therapy Centre, that people have different perspectives and they respect each other's perspectives, they listen to each other's perspectives, and they're informed by them, they're willing to be challenged by each other and listen to each other, understand where each other coming from. And so this other picture here,
by the way, you will find both pictures in the resource section of this podcast so that you can also have a look at them.
Yeah, so this one, so we see different people standing on a grid, as it were, and behind the grid as an elephant, and they're all looking at the same elephant, but they're seeing different parts of the elephant. And of course there's an ancient tale about people feeling an elephant and thinking they've found a different thing, and so on. One thinks they've found a snake and so on. But this is, I think this is where we're at. I mentioned yesterday, I think, Alfie, one of our conversations, in some ways I think of Solution Focus as a thing in the bushes. We kind of know it's there, and when we're all together, we all know it's there. We're all knowing the same thing, so there's something distinctly recognisable about Solution Focus. So it does exist in a way that can be recognised. The moment we start writing about it, we limit what it is, because words typically let us down, and all of us write with some sort of a rhinoceros horn in front of us, you know, so in a way that gets into it. And this particular picture says context matters, and I've been very, very passionate over the years about training people in such a way that they end up using solution focused in a way that kind of fits for them, kind of comes out of their mouth in a way that sounds right for them and is in some ways appropriate to the setting which they work. So for a long time I worked in CAMHS, and there were certain questions that others would ask elsewhere, and I'll ask them here, but they just didn't seem to fit, you know, because with a child and adolescent mental health service, people will have expectations and so on, and you know, there's a certain job, and if I'm too weird, then too much weirdness just doesn't work. You know, a certain degree of weirdness is helpful, but not too much. And one of the things I really liked about working with Greg Vinnicum was that both of us in our introductory courses carried a belief that not only were we talking about clients being unique, practitioners have a uniqueness about them. And so we want to create a space where they come to know this approach well through experiences and exercises and examples we show and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, the go away was something that is there and they're owning it. I don't know if it was us talking today or someone else about it. It's quite common at the beginning to copy, you know, and at the end of the day, you know, I was talking about my first encounter with Solution Focused in the way when I was back on the Monday, everyone got me copying. I was doing copying. I was copying other people. And I said at the time, these are great questions. It's like going to a shop and you just take a suit off a rack, you know, and it fits. And, you know, the tailor-made questions. I don't need to make them up. I just ask them, you know. So there is that. And that's good to start. But ultimately, for practice to be at its best, needs to be something that kind of fits and draws on the practitioner's strengths and resourcefulness and creativity and all of that, and make some sort of sense in the context in which people are. So, for example, I've now moved to private practice, and it's quite different. It's quite different from working in CAMHS. In some ways, it's freeing. In some ways, I'm freer. But in some ways, I'm constrained in different ways, because people come into private practice have different expectations. You know, some, for example, say, you know, I'll say, you know, what are your hopes? You know, what do you hope to get from coming here today? Oh, you know, I want some things to try out and that, you know. And I was like, oh, well, maybe Task will still have a place here then, you know. I could do that. Yeah, other people will want different things, you know. So, yeah.
And I love what you just shared about your training courses and also, well, getting the uniqueness of the practitioner in. And Naomi shared this wonderful story when she did her first training course in your team. And after the first day, she called you and said, like, oh, it's really great things, but I somehow feel, well, I could do better. And you really encouraged her to bring in her own style and her own way of working. And I think this is such a beautiful story of how you really walk the talk and encourage your team members to bring in the uniqueness in your training. And is, I think, or I guess, could be really hard for a lot of people to allow that, because you put together the training and, you know, and then they do something different with the material. But there's this trust, there's this also seeing the uniqueness and the brilliance of the other people and, well, encourage them and let them thrive.
Yeah, I mean, I'm smiling as you say that, because it was never that difficult to believe that was the way forward, that each trainer has to own the course, even though someone else has created the training materials. Because we, going back to when Greg and I created the course, we spent a vast amount of time designing this course. We made the PowerPoints, you had all the exercises, everything to kind of deliver the course. And Greg watched me deliver the first whole course, you know, and then I subsequently watched him deliver the course. At the end of my delivery of the course, Greg said, oh, I didn't think it would look like that. And then when I watched Greg, I'm sitting thinking, I didn't think it would look like this either. It's like, so we've both coloured it in our own way, which gave me some confidence. There's a kind of basic structure in the course design, which means anyone who comes to the course can expect to get something that's been worked out, you know, it's been thought through and so on, and will help them learn. However, there's enough space for trainers to own it and make it their own, yeah.
And it's a certified course, among others. ISD is certified, so you also do assess your participants in a solution-focused way.
Yeah, yeah.
But not only your participants, but also you yourself as trainers. So how do you do that?
Yeah, we assess each other, and there's an annual appraisal which works in a solution-focused way. People self-evaluate on scaling questions with various aspects of what they contribute to the training company. Yeah, we kind of struggled at the very beginning about it's a pass or fail course. So how do we do that in a solution-focused way? Yeah, and one, I think it was Pout in the workshop last week, said that creates attention, and it certainly does create attention. There was a Sol conference, trainers conference, I went to a few years back, and I invited people to come to an open space about that. How can we do this? How can we be the most solution-focused we can be in this particular endeavour, you know? I think Mark McCurgo said, well, first thing, just be very clear about what you expect of people. And so that's there on day one. And then we give people an exercise to reflect upon. So now you know what needs to be done to pass this course. What's required of you whilst you're here for that to happen? And so people do their own action plan based on what they know about themselves. And, you know, and people talk about setting time aside and, yeah, make sure they read and various things. They own that responsibility that it's down to them. Yeah, it's an externally validated course, so that means we have to have internal quality measures. So for each trainer, at least one of the courses one day will be observed by someone else. So there's me, there's Jan Turner, now that there's going to be Tara and Naomi. And that also includes there, so Jan Turner watches me, so I'm also part of that process. So it helps us all kind of keep on track and be the best we can.
So really also here learning from each other and with each other.
Yeah, yeah, oh, constantly. And they're all feedback loops, yeah. There's something that's also very interesting in that. So we have an external quality assessor from the National Awarding Body, NCFE. So Claire, one year when we met her for her annual audit, essentially, and each audit counts, you know, we have to be found fit for purpose. Otherwise, we can't issue certificates. She's saying, I noticed you're not rag rating your trainers. And immediately I thought, that sounds absolutely horrible. What are we talking about here? It's red, amber, green, you know, and just traffic lights, you know, and if a trainer is in the red zone, you know, that you've got to watch out for them. And this is so not solution focused. You know? But is there a way forward? And actually, Andrew Gibson was a nice source of consultation there because I mulled things over with him. And what we concluded, well, okay, we can have a form that does rag rating, but it's done with scaling. So 0 to 10, 0 up to 3 or something is red, and you know, then you go to amber, then you go to green, you know. So we kind of bridged two worlds, I think, you know, by having that form. So that's the tutor's annual appraisal, and that helps them. And then there's a targeted plan that comes from that that is then given to the internal quality assessor. So which means when they do the observation, what they notice, what they pay attention to is what the trainer knows they need to have attention paid to. It'll help them develop and become better.
Wow. There's so much experience in so many fields and such a also long journey with solution focus. So looking back on your journey with solution focus, if there's one thing, one insight, one learning that was really important for you on this journey, that might also make a difference for other people, people listening, what might that be?
Oh, goodness, that's such a big question. One learning. It's just the very, very earliest one, really, when you give people a chance to figure out for themselves. It's fascinating what people will come up with, and sometimes you have to wait a bit because many people have said to me, no one's asked me before. Mm. Yeah, and some of the specific questions, I've never heard a question like that before. So to be patient, so to both trust, to ask in the first place, assume people have resource, even if it's not obvious to me or them, ask and be patient. Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So let's come to the challenge of the week, John.
Yeah. So coming back to this diagram of, you know, we're all looking at an elephant that we love, you know, and we can all see it. We all see through our capacity to see, which is as broad as it can be, but also will always be limited. And we've all got kind of rhinoceros horns of some sort or another. So we have all of that. And at the end of the day, so we all end up doing practice that is the best we can make our practice. I suppose my challenge would be for all of us to, over the next few days where practice is happening, look out for what we kind of love most about our use of solution focused based on the benefit we see it bringing to the people we're working with. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this challenge. And yeah, we're curious to hear more about what you love about your practice. So let us know. Go and comment in the comment section of our podcast. So go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 72. There you'll also find the pictures that John mentioned in the podcast. And you'll also find a link to the EPTA conference that takes place in Florence from September 12th to 14th. John is not only hosting a post-conference workshop there, he's also on the board of the EPTA, and it will be a lovely conference. The conference program is out there, so go have a look and join us in Florence.
We are very much looking forward to being there, to seeing you and Marie again, and well, lots of other friends and practitioners. And now we are looking forward to go and visit a school in the afternoon together with you. John and Marie arranged a meeting with 230 kids at a school where we are invited to share our journey with kids, and we are very grateful for that because John really helped us to make a dream come true in that, to not only talk to adults but really also to groups of young people. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. And yeah, also you out there listening to this podcast, have a wonderful week and see you next week. Thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye.
Wow, what a great episode again. Do you like the Simply Focus podcast? Well, help Elfie and Dominic spread the word. Give the Simply Focus podcast an excellent rating on iTunes and Google Play and other platforms. This was the Simply Focus podcast with Elfie Cherney and Dominic Odat, your podcast for a life in joy and ease.